This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello once again, sports fans, and welcome to this special edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast, a proud member of the Sports History Network. I'm your host, Dana Auguster. This special edition is a series that I'm doing celebrating the 75th anniversary of the NBA. And right now we are reaching the climax of its 75th season, which is the NBA Finals, featuring the Golden State Warriors, who, as a franchise, while based in Philadelphia, won the very first NBA championship in 1947. Meanwhile, their opponents, the Boston Celtics, are tied with the Los Angeles Lakers with the most championships with 17. Right now, they're playing for their 18th banner to be hung in TD Garden. And I got to thinking, we had already did a couple of shows about the 75 greatest players. Now we're going to talk about the greatest teams in NBA history. Who was the greatest team, the best collection of players to hoist up the Larry O'Brien Trophy or the NBA Trophy before there was the Larry O'Brien Trophy? And to do that, we talked to who I call the Dean of Basketball History here at the Sports History Network. That is none other than Rick Loaiza. And his expertise and knowledge of the game is truly remarkable, and that is evidenced right here on this episode. Once again, this is the third show in a series that I'm doing celebrating the NBA's 75th anniversary. And coming up, me and Rick will sit down and have a discussion about the greatest teams in NBA history. So sit back, tune, pump up the volume, and check out this new latest special edition of the Sports History Network's Historically Speaking Sports. We'll be back right after this message.
With every race, every qualifying run, and every pit stop, Tim Coffeen would feel the pressure and excitement. With his own podcast on the Sports History Network called Tim Coffeen Talks IndyCar and Racing History, Tim will share those very same racing emotions and memories with his listeners. Learn, laugh, and enjoy the world of IndyCar racing through the eyes of Tim Coffeen.
Hello, welcome back to another edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast. I'm your host, Dana Auguster, and tonight we have another very special guest who's not a stranger to the program, and he is who I would call the Dean of Basketball History here at the Sports History Network, and it ain't nobody, none other than the great Rick Loaiza, who's coming to us, and should I say the award-winning podcaster from the Sports History Network, Rick Loaiza. And Rick, great to have you on board tonight. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Dana. Thank you for having me back. Yeah, I appreciate the kind introduction.
Oh, man, that is not a problem. Not a problem at all. We're going to be talking about something that I think that is maybe part of some of the great barbershop conversations and debates that you would have across the country, especially dealing with it being the 75th anniversary of the NBA. And that is some of the greatest teams ever. Now, in the NFL, everybody talks about the 72 Dolphins and the 85 Bears and that sort of thing. And in baseball, it's the 27 Yankees and so forth and so on. In the NBA, there's quite a few, you know, and there's, And I want to come to you because since, you know, you're like the resident basketball dean of the network, and I wanted to come to you and just wanted to talk to you about who do you think are some of the five greatest NBA teams ever. And then you could start off, I don't know if you have it listed or I don't know how you have them ranked or whatever, but just let's just dive into this conversation about it. First off, I want to say that I have about five I actually have like eight that are significant in my opinion. And again, I don't have them ranked, and you could just dive in and start off wherever you want to start off.
All right. Well, I put together five. So I got my five teams first and then ranked them. So my number one season in the NBA history was the 96 Chicago Bulls. They went 72-10. They won the championship, defeating Seattle in the finals. So that, to me, was the greatest season ever. Michael Jordan won MVP that year. He led the league in scoring, 30 points a game. Rodman led the league in rebounding at just under 15. Of course, Pippen and Kukoc, the whole crew. Because they had, I know the Warriors broke that regular season record with 73, but they didn't win the championship. So I can't make them number one, so I had to go with the Bulls, 72-10, and the championship.
Well, I mean, I remember that team because I was around, and I remember watching that team, and this seemed almost unstoppable. That was the first, that year they played the Sonics in the finals, and it just seemed like Seattle coming into that series as well. They had a very remarkable team as well. They finally got to the finals 2 years after suffering the biggest upset in the history of the NBA postseason, losing to Denver in five. And then they were a very formidable team because I think they won, if I'm not mistaken, like 58 or 59 games that year. And any other year, they would have been a prohibitive favorite. But course, you're going against Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Tony Kukoc, Dennis Rodman, and the Bulls that went 72-10, which is the first team ever to break 70. In fact, I remember the game they broke the 70 win mark. It was against Milwaukee, if I'm not mistaken. And Michael Jordan had something of an off night, but you had the supporting cast there. And I think that team is one of the most complete teams in NBA history that you could at least, you could say that they were from top to bottom bench players. And of course you have the coaches with Phil Jackson. That was probably one of the most best top to bottom teams across the board maybe you've ever seen in this league.
Absolutely. One of the things I remember about that time that I can't remember which coach said it to Phil Jackson, but they said, Phil, you are so lucky. And he said, well, what do you mean? He goes, your two best offensive players, Jordan and Pippen, are also your two best defensive players. And so he doesn't have to substitute like other coaches do. Other coaches will take an offensive guy off the floor because he needs defense and vice versa. Phil Jackson could just ride Jordan and Pippen knowing they're going to play both ends of the court at an elite level. And that year, just my opinion, Jordan, Pippen, and Rodman were the best defender at their respective positions in the entire league. You had the best defender at the two, the three, and the four. And yes, what are you going to do with that?
It was, and I think also that team, if you really think about it, they were the ones who kind of brought in or introduced like what we see today, like positionless basketball, because there was no set point guard on that team. There was no set center. It was like five of your best players that were so interchangeable, especially, and also with Tex Winter running the triangle offense, which was the height of the that offensive prime, running the triangle. And that was the staple of those Chicago Bulls throughout the entire decade of the 90s, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You're right, because you would see that's the beauty of the triangle is, Ron Harper technically was the point guard, but you would see Jordan bring the ball up, Pippen would bring the ball up. It was interchangeable, like you said. You had Longley in the post. He was never going to go outside. But sometimes you had Rodman sitting in the post. You had Jordan in the post. You had Pippen in the post. Like, you had four guys who could play in the post at any given possession. It was, they could do anything and everything you wanted. That team did not have a weakness. I don't think there was anything any coach could have done to say, this is what we're going to attack them. It just, and what you said earlier, just to piggyback what you said earlier, if it wasn't for those Bulls teams, there were a whole lot of other teams that could have won a championship, like Seattle. If the Bulls aren't there, if Jordan's still playing baseball, then Seattle wins that championship, I think. And then a lot of guys without rings because of Jordan.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a prime example, Reggie Miller and Patrick Ewing in 96. Yeah. I mean, the season before 90, I mean, then you had a young, you know, Orlando Magic team, you know, who eliminated the Bulls the year before, you know, when Jordan came back from playing baseball. You had that. I mean, the NBA during the mid-90s was so loaded talent-wise that, I mean, you see it now in the way that the league is right now is very reminiscent of those of the 1990s, you know, because you had so many different teams. You know, if you took Michael Jordan and the Bulls out of the equation, I really do think that you have the New Yorks, the Indianas, Miami was good. Yeah. You know, and then that's just in the Eastern Conference. In the West, you had Seattle, Utah, Houston, who had won back-to-back NBA titles. San Antonio was up there, you know, with David Robinson and Sean Elliott. You had so many great teams in the 1990s, but of course, you have Michael Jordan and you have Scottie Pippen and, of course, the ringmaster himself, you know, Coach Phil Jackson, running the show, you know, running those Bulls teams. That was, you know, probably the top of the top. And to be honest, that was my number one, the 96 Bulls. That was my number one as far as like the greatest team I have ever seen, you know. And I think, you know, I think, like I said before, you and I may be in agreement on that, you know, with, you know, the Bulls being the best team in the 75-year history of the league.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd never seen the way that season went for the Bulls. I'd never seen anything like that. By like that whole three-peat, because everything, they were still the same core team in 97, 98, but that was just something else. And I think it'll be quite a while. I mean, the Warriors are really close. This current Warriors dynasty, I mean, it is right there behind that Jordan Bulls three-peat. But yeah, it's like every 20 years you see a team that dominates the way they dominate for an extended period.
Okay, now we're gonna go to the next team that's on your list. You know, we got the 96 Bulls out of the way. Who is next on your list?
All right, this I think we might diverge a little bit because I know you're a Celtics fan. I'm a Lakers fan, so at number two, I put the 1972 LA Lakers. They went 69-13. Coached by Bill Sharman. That was Jerry West, Will Chamberlain, Gail Goodrich. Elgin Baylor started the season, and this was just so crazy. Elgin Baylor started the season, but retired 9 games into the season because his knees were just hurting so much. And the day he retired was when they started that 33-game winning streak, when Jim McMillian stepped in for Baylor to start, and they ran off 33 in a row. That's my number two team. They ran through that season. They just bulldozed their way through that season.
Well, I'm not mad at you for putting that team on the list because I have them on my list as well. It's a win to 33. Now, the whole thing with Elgin Baylor, I did not realize that he retired 9 games. I knew he retired. I knew he wasn't on the team when they made it to the finals against the New York Knicks. But I never knew that he retired 9 games and replaced by Jim McMillan and reeled off the 33 wins in a row, which is the longest winning streak in the history of North American pro sports, believe it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And what's funny about that, I was looking through the some of the player stats from that year. I didn't realize that the leading scorer was Gail Goodrich. And there's no offense to Goodrich. He's in the Hall of Fame for a reason, but he was the leading scorer at 25.9. West was right behind him at 25.8. And Will Chamberlain, and then it was Jim McMillian, and then Will Chamberlain was fourth in scoring on that team.
It was a very balanced team. It wasn't like the Lakers team of old, whenever you had like West and Chamberlain and Baylor doing their thing. It was more balanced, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And what was interesting, I remember watching something about that team, and Will Chamberlain himself said that was one of the least talented teams he had ever played on.
I think
he said he played on teams that would have made that team look like nothing, but they just caught fire, you know, and won 33 in a row, which was amazing to me.
I still sometimes Chamberlain said stuff that had me scratching my head. I'm like, come on, man. I mean, come on. I know because he played on one of my. I have another team on this list. he was Will Chamberlain, I think, is the only player. Yes, he's the only player that are on two of my top five teams. And I think that's because he really loved his 1967 76ers team. That was his favorite season to play on. And I think the fact that this team broke the record by winning 69, broke the record by one game that his old team had done. But you know, I give Chamberlain a lot of credit though as a player. I mean, he was getting older. He was 35 that season. And I think finally he decided, if I play the way Bill Russell played, I think that's what this team needs, was rebounding and defense. Because he only scored 15 points a game, which for Chamberlain was low, but he pulled 20 rebounds. I mean, he just handled the paint defensively, and because he knew he had scorers around him.
Right. I mean, you have Goodrich, West, you know, McMillan, who filled in for Baylor, you know, and Goodrich is one of those guards that I think, yeah, granted, he's in the Hall of Fame, but a lot of people don't know about him and realize how good he really was. You know, even going back to his days at UCLA, he was an unbelievable, great point guard, you know, and he was, you know, Pat Riley was on that team as well, you know, as a reserve, you know, which a lot of people don't realize. But you know, that's not a bad choice. You know, I'm not mad at you for doing that. I know you're a Laker fan, like you said, and I'm a Celtic fan. But, you know, putting that team on that list is, you know, that's – I have to give you kudos for that. You know, I don't want to, but I have to.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it. And that's the of my top five. It's the last thing I'll say about this. Of all my top five teams, the 72 Lakers were the only ones that did not have the league MVP on their team that year. Kareem
was the MVP of it.
He was still with Milwaukee at the time. All the other teams that we'll get to here, they all have the MVP on their team that year.
All right. That's another nugget I didn't realize, you know. But that Laker team in 72, despite the fact that they won 33 in a row, that's sort of surprising that they did not, you know, they didn't have the MVP. But that just goes to show you the coaching style of Bill Sharman at the time, you know, because he took over from Brian Bredikoff, and he preached more of a defensive oriented. He brought a little bit from a little Celtic tradition from, you know, to the Lakers, to LA, you know, more of a team oriented type of basketball, which with that squad, it really worked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill Sharman knew how to put together a team. He learned a lot, you know, playing under Auerbach with Bill Russell and Cousy and those other guys and Sam Jones. And yeah, he learned how to develop a team from being on the Celtics. So it's still, even though I love those Lakers, it still irks me a bit that it took a Celtic to help the Lakers win the championship.
Nicely put. Okay, so we talked about the 96 Bulls and we talked about the 72 Lakers. And again, those are two teams that I have on my list of top five. Okay, those are two. So who you got next on your list?
Yeah, this one I know you're going to have on your list. The 1986 Boston Celtics. They went 67 and 15. Casey Jones was leading the way. Larry Bird won MVP that year, led the team in scoring. And they just rolled through and they ended up beating the Houston Rockets in the finals, which was unexpected because everybody thought they were going to meet up with the Lakers again after they just played in 84. They were looking forward to the Lakers, and the Lakers got upset by the Houston Rockets and the Rockets. They just weren't ready. They weren't ready for that big stage.
That was one of, you know, the infamous Ralph Sampson shot against the Lakers to eliminate them. That sticks in the craw of every Laker fan I know, because my best friend is a diehard Laker fan. And I remember we were watching that game in his living room. I was a Celtic fan. He was a Laker fan. And we watched it. When Sampson hit that miracle shot to beat them in the Forum, he almost got punished because he took something and threw it at the TV, luckily missed, and his mama caught him. And I'm sitting there cracking up laughing, and at the same time in total shock that Ralph Sampson hit like a shot. He just like threw it off the back of his head and it just went in.
He wasn't even looking.
He didn't even look. He just threw it up because it was they're really up against the clock. But that 86 Celtic team, 41-1 at home.
Yes. The best home record ever.
You know, trivia question. Who did they lose to in that final? Who did they lose that one game to?
It's somebody they should not have lost to. I want to say, but no, I can't remember.
It was Portland.
Oh, my word.
It was Portland. Yeah. They lost to Portland in December of that year. In December of 85, they lost to the Trailblazers in the Garden with a young Clyde Drexler, which is one of my favorite players, by the way. Anyway, but that Celtic team, they just buzzed through the Houston Rockets, you know, in six games, if I'm not mistaken, you know. But that Rockets team, they got there, but they were just not really ready for prime time. At least not ready against that Celtic team.
Yeah, I mean, you got Hakeem Olajuwon was only in his second year with the team, so he was still learning. I mean, Ralph Sampson was only in his third year. Sampson was only in his third year, so they didn't really have that veteran leadership to help him kind of navigate, you know, what it is to play in the finals. Meanwhile, you got the Celtics that had already won. They'd already won two championships, and I think this was their fourth trip of the decade.
They had been 1-81 against the Rockets. Yeah. You know, they beat the Rockets in 81, and then they went back in 84, and they beat the Lakers in 84. They lost to the Lakers in 85, and they were back in 86. You know, this was their third consecutive Eastern Conference championship going up against the Houston Rockets, and the Celtics was a huge favorite, you know, over Houston. But you know, you look at that team, you know, this was at the height of the Celtic dynasty of the 80s, you know, with Bird, McHale, and Parrish, you know, Dennis Johnson, Danny Ainge, you know, you had guys like Scott Wedman coming off the bench. You had Greg Kite coming off the bench. You had a lot of really solid players on that team that was coming off the bench for the Celtics team. And they just seemed like they just did everything right. Also, not to mention Bill Walton, you know, who had won a championship with Portland, and then he came in and doing, I think it was the year before, or maybe that earlier that year, they engineered a trade to get Bill Walton into Boston. And he was like that final piece, you know, like, not that he really needed a final piece, but it was just an additional piece of additional veteran leadership, you know, that would help the Celtics along in the postseason that year.
Yeah, that was one of only for Walton in his entire career. Because everybody knows how injured he was. He missed like almost 70% of his career due to injury. But that year with the Celtics, he played the most games he ever, that was the healthiest year he ever had. He played 80 out of 82 games that year. And none of his other seasons even come close in terms of how many games he played. So they got a healthy Walton. Arbach rolled the dice and he was there for them. And yeah, he was a big piece of that because he was such a good passer. I mean, you want to call him, I mean, just kind of making up a term here, you know, point center.
Yeah.
Walton, he could pass almost as well as Bird could pass. And to have two of those guys that just love being playmakers, man, he supercharged them. I mean, they were great already, but he coming off the bench, coming in for Parrish or McHale, he was just another piece that just helped him dominate.
Yeah, one thing I remember about the 86 Celtics that – you know, you think about, you know, the front line of, you know, Bird, Parrish, and McHale, but the backcourt doesn't really get a lot of notoriety with Ainge and Dennis Johnson. Dennis Johnson was the one that you could basically put on their best player and have him play defense, and Danny Ainge was just an irritant, who was a streak shooting irritant, you know, and every great Celtic team has always had that one guy that nobody like really likes, you know, and Danny Ainge fit that role perfectly.
He took over for Cedric Maxwell.
Exactly.
But you're right.
Exactly.
DJ's in the Hall of Fame, rightly so, you know, and Ainge, yeah. I mean, they were solid. They had four Hall of Famers in the starting lineup, and then Danny Ainge, who was a solid player. a good outside shooter, and then he probably outdid his playing career with his executive career, because he was such a good executive. But that was a lot of experience. These are guys who had been around. They knew what it was to win. They knew what it was to play as a team. And they're one of the greats, one of the great teams.
All right. So we got the 96 Bulls, you had the 72 Lakers, and then you have the 86 Boston Celtics. Now, who's next on your list?
Yeah, next I had was the 1967 76ers. I had mentioned them already. They were 68-13, which at the time set the record for most wins in a season with 68. And Chamberlain was their MVP. They had Hall of Famer Hal Greer. They had Hall of Famer Billy Cunningham. Those guys are on the 75 list as well. That was the only year that Bill Russell didn't play in the finals.
Yes.
Was with 1967 when Philadelphia took them out in the Eastern Conference Finals. But yeah, they the record for most wins in a season. They win the championship. They knocked out Russell and the Celtics. Chamberlain wins MVP. They were, they're just loaded, absolutely loaded.
That was one of those years that you may find every now and then in sports that the two best teams in the league that year faced off in the series just short of the finals. Because yes. You had the Celtics and the Sixers. Those are the two best teams in the league that year. And then Philly ended up playing the San Francisco Warriors.
Yeah, that his old team.
Yeah, they ended up playing the San Francisco Warriors for the NBA championship with Rick Barry and Nate Thurman.
Yes.
Then you had, not only that Philadelphia team had Hal Greer and they had Will Chamberlain, but they also had Wally Jones, they had Chet the Jet Walker, had a young Matt Gukas, who a lot of people remember as being an announcer for the NBA when it was on NBC. Coached by Alex Hannum. That was a very, very, very solid team. They interrupted the Celtic dynasty, because they had won all these championships in a row. But when it came down to 1967, if I'm not mistaken, that was Bill Russell's first year as a player coach.
Yes.
His first year as being a player coach. And they ended up beating the Celtics in Philly in six games. And a lot of people were wondering whether the Celtic dynasty had ended because the players were getting so old. They had played so many games over the years. And you had this young Philadelphia 76er team who finally got over the hump and beating the Celtics after losing to them year after year after year in the Eastern Conference Finals. And they finally got through and they ended up beating a very good and one thing about that series that a lot of people don't remember was Rick Barry of how his I think if I'm not mistaken he still has the highest scoring finals per game average ever. I think he averaged something like 38 or 36 points per game in the finals that year for a team that lost. Everybody talks about Jerry West was the first player to win MVP that came from a losing team, but they didn't have the MVP award back then. Had they had it, is a possibility that Rick Barry could have been finals MVP despite them being on the losing team.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they had, I remember Matt Gukas as the coach. I think he coached Orlando.
Yeah, he did. He coached Orlando for a while. I think he coached a little while for Philly as well.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. And they had another guy I know he barely played. His name is Bob Weiss, and he, I think, very briefly coached the Hawks.
Yes,
he didn't contribute much to this team. But, yeah, they interrupted that the title. And I'm sure in Boston they were probably fans were upset, if Auerbach had been there, if Auerbach had been on the sideline, maybe that wouldn't have turned out that way. But obviously Bill Russell proved himself. They came back and won the next two as player coach. So. His legacy is secure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think back, that 67 team, and we talked about Gail Goodrich being an underrated Hall of Famer. How about Hal Greer?
Yeah, I do an entire episode, went way back, I forget even how far back it is, but on Hal Greer is one of the unsung great guards in NBA history. Nobody talks about, who are the great guards? It seems like everybody – you'll talk about, Jordan is one of the great guards. You'll talk about, you know, today maybe it's like CP3. You talk about Steph Curry, but Hal Greer gets lost in the shuffle because he played in the shadow of Wilt Chamberlain, even though he was a legitimate scorer. He averaged 22 that season they won, but he was in the high to mid, you know, mid to high 20s almost his whole career. And he's just one of those guys that just doesn't get talked about, but that guy could bring it any night of the week. As a scorer, he had one of the great, well, back then, they would have considered it outside shot. Today we call it a mid range. Back then, that was an outside shot, and he could fill it up.
You know, Hal Greer, you also talked about Billy Cunningham. You know, guys, you know, like our age, remember him as being the head coach of the Sixers when they won the championship in 83. But a lot of people don't remember him being such of a great player, a.k.a. the Kangaroo Kid from North Carolina. You know, he was a very, very good athletic forward.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because he called the name Kangaroo because of his leaping ability. You know, he was a little bit undersized, but back then he made it work. He averaged, 18? I think I have it down here as 18 that championship season. He was legit, too. And again, gets because of his success as a coach of the Sixers, I think it kind of outshines what he did as a player for the Sixers, which was significant. He deserves to be on the 75 list. You know, unfortunately, with a lot of these old guys, and I talk about this a lot in my show, it's just because there's not enough video. Compared to guys today, there just isn't enough video to really sit there and make, even though anybody who saw them play goes, oh yeah, Cunningham definitely deserves the accolades. It's just, you know, you put a highlight package together of these guys and it's like 2 minutes long compared to guys today, you know.
I mean, you get 2 minutes out of a week, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Because they just didn't have, they weren't archiving all the games like they do today. So there's a lot of that is just lost. They play games without any cameras. And so it's just kind of a shame we don't have that video to go to. We have a little bit, but just not enough, really.
Okay, now we're going to wrap it up with your fifth team. You have the Bulls in 96. You had the 72 Lakers, the 86 Celtics, and the 67 76ers.
Yeah. This next one, I really struggled with this one. And who would I put here? Because, and as I said, I had the 2016 Warriors. And the reason I struggle was because they didn't win the championship. But at the same time, I didn't want to take away from the fact that they still went 73-9. The best regular season record of all time. Watching them through the regular season, I mean, they were just a force. All five players moving around. The ball touching almost everybody's hands on every possession. And then, you know, getting it to Steph or Clay for that 3-pointer. But it was more than just the Splash Brothers. I mean, they I just loved what they did. I love the way Steve Kerr, you know, coaches that team, bringing, you know, all the best of the triangle from his Bulls days, but also bringing in like defensive principles that he learned under Popovich when he played with the Spurs and just kind of, you know, mixing it all together with the guys that he's got. And I kind of was reluctant, but I put him at my number five just because they did. I mean, it was just one game, right? It was one game. If they win game seven, then I'm putting them up at least number two, debatable number one, if they win that game seven. But because they lost that one game, it just took them down to five for me. That's where I have them.
I mean, I can't debate you on that because, again, it was like that Warriors team with Curry and Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, you know, Iguodala. You know, I mean, those guys, it was like watching the Harlem Globetrotters at times.
Yeah.
Because it was, I mean, it was like, and Steve Kerr had pretty much did something that no one really thought was possible in basketball. He took the best elements of those Bulls teams that he was on and the best elements of those of the Bulls and the best elements of the Spurs and put them together and also gave his players latitude to be themselves. With those three things going, those three aspects of that team, that made them almost unstoppable. But them going up against LeBron in Cleveland in that finals, they weren't going to be denied.
Yeah. And I think, and I know people can debate this, whatever, but if was it a game was it game five that Draymond got that technical?
Yes.
And he had to miss game six. If Draymond does not get that technical and he finishes game five and plays game six. Yeah, I don't.
Then history may be different.
It's quite different because he's such a key part of their defense. Well, and their offense too. But I mean, he's one of those guys that when he's not there, you feel it. You know, he's not a leading scorer. He wasn't leading the league in rebounds, but he knows how to make everything run more smoothly when he's out there. And I think they really missed him. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that Golden State Warriors team, I mean, again, was so much fun to watch. And Golden State, for a lot of years, even before the Splash Brothers, was a very fun team to watch, believe it or not, because even though they weren't winning a lot of games, and when they beat the Mavericks in the playoffs, I think it was in 07, you know, when they upset the Mavericks, it gave people like a little bit of around the country, a little bit of an idea of what basketball was like in the Bay Area if the Warriors were good, you know, because they had like one of the most raucous crowds, them and Sacramento, but in my opinion, two of the most raucous crowds in the NBA, especially when their teams are good. And you kind of like saw a little preview of that, even though that team wasn't there yet. But, you know, we had Steph Curry and Klay Thompson as the Splash Brothers. They were, again, like I said, they were like the Harlem Globetrotters of the NBA, you know, without the striped shorts. They were just so great. You know, they were just so much fun to watch. And it was – and them not being on – them being – not winning a championship, you know, it's like, wow. You know, like seeing them win 73-9, you know, and – not winning it, that's almost like what the Patriots had done in the NFL, going undefeated and losing in the final minute to the Giants. That's essentially that's like the NBA's version of that.
Yeah, it was, because I think in that game seven, I mean, they only lost by like 3 or 4 points. I don't remember the exact score, but it came into that final minute where LeBron comes out of nowhere to block Iguodala.
Yeah,
and then they come right back and Kyrie hits that dagger three-pointer, and that kind of closed the door. But the Warriors were there until like the final 30 seconds.
Yes. You know, and that was like one of the more exciting NBA finals, you know, because it kept going back and forth. You had controversy with Draymond Green, and you had the dramatic Game 7 finish. You know, because when LeBron blocked the shot, I came out of my chair like, oh, my God, he blocked it. And I'm thinking to myself, could Cleveland finally win, you know? Yeah. You know, so that's what I was thinking, you know, and that's exactly what happened. They Kyrie hits the big three-pointer from the elbow, and I remember him hitting that shot, and I'm like, oh, my God, they're going to actually win it. And that was, you know, I don't know if you could call that an upset in a way. You could, on paper you could, but I don't know. You know, would you consider that finals an upset?
Well, I mean, if you get to the finals, you're there for a reason. So Cleveland was there for a reason. But yeah, I mean, the Warriors were so heavily favored. And I guess that's the only way to look at it. They were so heavily favored that, yeah, I think it qualifies as an upset. You know, they really should have won. Draymond should not have gotten that technical in game five.
Right.
I mean, that was a huge moment. That was a huge moment. That opened the door for Cleveland. And I mean, it didn't have to be opened from the Warriors' perspective. Right. And I did want to say something else, because I lived in the Bay Area from 92 to 97. I lived in the Bay Area, went to college out there. And I remember thinking the Warriors weren't very good back then. But I remember just living in there. I was like, man, you guys really love the Warriors right here. They're not very good.
They do. They really do. You know, and it'd been like that for years. Being from Louisiana, living in Louisiana at the time, now I'm living in Atlanta, but, you know, living and growing up in Louisiana, we would catch a Warriors game on TV every now and then. And you would see them even during the days of the Run TMC days with Mitch Richmond and Tim Hardaway and Chris Mullin. They were filling it up then. And maybe it's just something in the water with them scoring a lot of points and being very exciting games to watch. And the fans are just so into it out there. It was incredible.
Yeah, no, they definitely, and yeah, having lived there, having seen it, I went to a couple of Warriors games back then. And yeah, the crowd, they show up. Warriors fans show up, and I'll give them credit. I mean, what they're doing now is incredible, but that fan base has been like that going back to when the team moved out there from Philadelphia, moved out to become the San Francisco Warriors. Man, they were on board from day one.
Now, I have, like, a few on here that I think deserve, like, honorable mention.
Okay.
Okay. But you pretty much, like I said before, you pretty much completed my five. Because those are the five that I have down, you know?
Oh, wow.
Those are the five that I have down. And, you know, not necessarily in that order, but I had the Bulls, the 96 Bulls number one. I have, no, I take that back. We don't have the same order. We don't have the, you know, the. There's one team that's on my five that you didn't include.
Okay.
Number two is the Celtics of 86. But number three was the 1983 Philadelphia 76ers with Dr. J and Moses Malone, the faux Sixers. Yeah. You know, with Moses Malone, Dr. J, Maurice Cheeks, Andrew Toney, a.k.a. the Boston Strangler. I think Lionel Hollins was on that team. Bobby Jones, Mark Ivoroni, you know, those guys that just blew through the playoffs. I think they lost like two games in the entire postseason. They swept the Lakers in four in the finals. Yeah. I didn't want to bring that up, but you know, that was the first finals I remember watching as a kid, the very first one. Yeah. I was 10 years old in the summer of 83, and that was the first finals I ever watched, and I fell in love with it ever since. But, yeah, the Philadelphia 76ers, the Dr. J and Moses Malone, they were dominant, and it was finally got Dr. J over the hump. You know, we finally got a championship when Moses arrived from Houston.
And that I don't even know what the thought process was, because they had all these Hall of Famers on that team. A lot of the guys you mentioned, a bunch of them are in the Hall of Fame, but they couldn't get past the Celtics, right?
No.
And then in that summer, the summer right before in 82, you know, Moses Malone, he wins the MVP for Houston in 82. And then Houston traded him to the 76ers. And I think 76ers only gave up Daryl Dawkins and maybe a pick or something. Like they basically stole Moses Malone, the reigning MVP, and he wins MVP again.
Yes, exactly. And and Philly finally wins the championship with the Doc, you know, and that was, in my opinion, one great team. I have two more. I got two more that's honorable mention. That should be mentioned. One, the 71 Milwaukee Bucks with Kareem and Oscar Robertson together. You know, that, I mean, the youngest expansion team to win an NBA championship, because that was like what, their third year of existence?
It was only their third year of existence, and they're the champions.
Yeah, it was only their third year, and then they end up winning the whole thing because the engine they drafted Kareem out of UCLA based on a coin flip with them in Phoenix, and then they engineered a trade to get Oscar Robertson. And then you had some great players on that team, like Lucius Allen was on the team, John McLaughlin was on that team. They had a deep, very, very deep squad in Milwaukee, and they had, if I'm not mistaken, they made the playoffs the year before they got Oscar with Kareem, a young Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. They had made the playoffs the year before, if I'm not mistaken, but they lost to the Knicks. Yeah, I forgot which who it was.
Yeah, it was something like that. Because Kareem was a game changer. And I actually made this joke because I talk about it in one of my episodes, because you said it came down to that coin flip between Milwaukee and Phoenix. Whoever wins the coin flip gets Kareem. And I said, and then Phoenix took Neil Walk. I said, you ever heard of Neil Walk?
That's right. That's right. That's one of the great trivia questions of all time.
I had to look the guy up.
That's one of the great trivia questions of all basketball trivia questions of all time. You know, Kareem went one. Who went number two to Phoenix? Neil Walk. And the other team that I have on this list, and I would be in deep trouble if I did not mention this on my podcast because of my godfather, who is a big New York Knicks fan. And he says, and he always said, I have to agree with him, the 73 Knicks.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, because if you look at that team, the entire starting five is in the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
The entire starting five is in the Hall of Fame. The coach is in the Hall of Fame. You also have another player. Jerry Lucas is in the Hall of Fame. Phil Jackson, who's in the Hall of Fame, but not as a player, but as a coach. You know, that team, if that team is the definition of loaded.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that kind of talent, it's insane. Like 7 or 8 Hall of Famers on that team.
And not to mention, they have one of the greatest games in NBA history was game 6 in Boston in that Eastern Conference Finals. And of all people, Dean Meminger comes off the bench and destroys the Celtics. And people still talk about the quote unquote the dream game. And you know, with Dean Meminger, you know, with that, you know, then you also had Dave Stallworth on that team. You had some really solid players on that 73 Knicks team. And if I didn't mention him, I would be in deep trouble with my godfather, because he's a diehard Knicks fan. Bless his soul. Bless his heart.
That definitely deserves an honorable mention. What's so great about those Knicks teams in the 73 is I don't think anybody. I'd have to look it up, but I don't think anybody averaged more than 15 or 16 a game. But it was like four of them were all in that kind of like between 14. It was like five guys all scoring between 14 and 16 a game. It was that you couldn't concentrate on anybody because everybody could shoot that ball. Everybody could shoot that ball.
And then the Knicks engineered a trade to get Earl Monroe.
Yeah.
And what was so great about it was that when he came over from Baltimore, there was a lot of people that thought that it wouldn't work.
No.
With Clyde Frazier and Earl Monroe in the same backcourt. But what happened was that Earl basically curtailed his game to fit the system, which you don't really see now.
No, he did, because he walked to that team. He's like, all right, this team has already won a championship. I'm trying to win a championship. I just want to fit in. And that was incredible on the part of Earl Monroe to approach it like that. And when he walked into that locker room, like on the first day he shows up at practice, everybody in there kind of came up, shook his hand, said, welcome to the team. And the one guy who kind of hung back a little bit was Frazier, because he knew that this guy plays the same position. We've been battling each other in the Eastern Conference back when there were fewer teams. So they would play each other 8-9 times a season. But then finally Clyde goes, hey man, it's cool. If you're cool, I'm cool. Let's do this. And he was able to relax and just, you know, fit into what they were doing. That team deserves so much credit for how they approached the game, the way they shared the ball, they moved. I don't think those players led the league in any one category, because again, everybody was scoring in the teens. Nobody was scoring in the 20s. Nobody was grabbing rebounds in the high teens. I mean, everybody shared the load. And almost every way you slice and dice it, they were just – everybody helped carry their load and get through the championship.
One thing about that Knicks team that I hear so often from guys who watched – who've seen them play, both fans and media people alike, is that – the thrill watching that team is what was so thrilling was they passed the ball so well. Everything about them was so fundamentally solid that it was almost, you know, you can't find anything wrong with that team, because like you were saying, nobody's on that team is averaging more than 15 points a game. Nobody on that team is, there's not one person that you can concentrate on defensively. I mean, think about it, you got Earl Monroe and Walt Frazier in the backcourt. It's impossible for both of them to have bad games. Okay.
Yeah.
Then you have Dave DeBuscher, Willis Reed, and Bill Bradley in the front court.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got Jerry Lucas coming off the bench.
I know. Yes.
You know, how did they lose?
I'm trying to figure out how they stayed under the salary cap with all those
guys. I know, with all that talent, multiple all-stars, each one of them, you know, and then you coach, and then you're being coached by Red Holtzman, who's one of the most underrated coaches ever. He won two championships with the Knicks in New York City, which nobody has ever done before. Nobody's ever won a championship with other than Red Holtzman in New York. But
yeah,
he's one of the most underrated coaches ever.
He's the other Red, you know, yes. that people don't talk about. Yeah, he deserves to be out there. He wasn't even looking to be the coach. He was like the scout.
Yeah.
He's like the head scout for the team. And they're like, hey, how about you become an assistant? He's like, yeah, okay, maybe. And then he's the head coach. He's like, okay. He's like, I don't know, I'm looking for this, but okay. And he did a magical job keeping, you know, they played such hard defense. And I did a story back. It was a Willis Reed story, but I talk about the fact that that had to be also one of the smartest teams in NBA. I mean, academically smart. And I talk about the fact that Bill Bradley was a Rhodes Scholar.
A Rhodes Scholar, yes, right.
Yeah. Jerry Lucas, I want to get this right. Yeah. Jerry Lucas, he wrote books on memory. He would memorize huge sections of the New York City phone book and then go on talk shows and show people how his memory was. So he has like a photographic memory. And I think Stallworth got his, or not Stallworth. Is that my thinking that right? Yeah.
Oh, was it Dick Barnett?
Barnett. Yeah. So you're right. No, it was Barnett. Got a PhD after
he has a PhD in education.
And got a college professor.
Yeah.
And then it's like these guys could have played a team version of Jeopardy, and they would have smoked everybody. Basketball or Jeopardy? What do you want? We'll smoke you both ways.
Right. They were academic. They were just very, very cerebral people. Each one of those guys, you know. But yeah, this was awesome, Rick. I really appreciated this. Going down memory lane on the NBA, talking with the professor.
Yeah, thank you very much. No, it's so much fun to be here. So much fun to talk to you. You know, sometimes, I don't, because my family, they're sick of me talking about basketball all the time. So to be able to sit down and talk with somebody who's extremely knowledgeable about the game, and can, you know, rattle stuff off the top of their head. It just has that deep knowledge like you do. It's just a total pleasure for me.
Oh, man. Thanks a lot, man. And once again, let me reintroduce you. The host of Basketball History 101, Mr. Rick Loaiza, who is also a member of the Sports History Network. Rick, one more time, man. Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, too.
We here at the Sports History Network proudly partner with 26 podcasts, all revolving around the history of sports. But did you know that many of our hosts were sports history authors way before they started their shows? It's true. We've got Joe Ziemba, host of When Football Was Football. Joe Zagurski, host of Pro Football in the 1970s. Mark Morthier, host of Yesterday's Sports. Tommy Phillips, host of Lombardi Memories, and Scott Adamson, co-host of From the 55-Yard Line. All these authors have many books for you to choose from. To check them out, go to our website at sportshistorynetwork.com/sportshistorybooks. Pick up your copy today! Soundtrack provided by Kevin MacLeod of filmmusic.io.
And that will do it for this edition of the Historically Speaking Sports Podcast. Once again, I would like to thank Rick Loaiza for coming on and talking NBA history and dropping some knowledge on us on this particular episode. He's a longtime show friend, contributor to the show, longtime friend. So I want to thank him once again for coming on. And please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you hear podcasts. And also, don't forget to check out our Twitter feed at HistoricallySP2. You can check us out on Twitter there. Also, you can drop us a line or two at historically.speaking.sports@gmail.com. And please, once again, don't forget to subscribe. I'm your host, Dana Augusta, saying so long, and I'll check you out next time.